The Hoopheads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Let me take a moment to let everyone know about the upcoming BTS Summit in St. Louis on September 27th and 28th. If you haven't heard, BTS is a comprehensive program for running a long-term, profitable, high-quality youth basketball training company. It allows someone to have a career in youth basketball, helping young people become the best they can be both on and off the court. I am honored to have Larry Hughes, 13-year NBA veteran and a co-founder of BTS, here to tell us what this summit is all about. Larry, tell us about the upcoming summit and what it's all about.
Mike, thanks and congratulations on your Hoopheads podcast. We established the summit to provide people interested in building a successful youth basketball program the opportunity to come in for 2 days of learning what we do, how we do it, and how they can apply our system to grow their programs. In March, I opened up our 16,000 square foot facility with leading technology used by several NBA teams, which tracks every shot, every movement on the court, allowing us to objectively assess the progress of our members. People who join the summit will get a chance to use the technology and learn how we integrate it into our programs. We will have David Martin, recently head analytics of the 76ers, speak about direction of technology in basketball. We will also have presentations and workshops on how to effectively build back office systems to create memorable experiences for members and build long-term value in the business. We want to empower the attendees to take their basketball organizations to the next level. So the first 30 signups get to participate for free. Thereafter, it's $199 per person. We have arranged discounted hotels in the area. The event also offers the opportunity to network with others in similar circumstances. We're excited to provide this opportunity to market and think that all attendees will get extraordinary value for attending.
Larry, the summit sounds great. Where can people go to learn more and get signed up?
They can go to basketballtrainingsystems.com/summit to learn more or call us at 301-602-3001.
Thanks, Larry. I'm hoping to make it out to St. Louis myself.
In the fourth grade, I was so in love with the game. I didn't know the vehicle would be coaching, but I just never, ever wanted to be without the game.
Mike Dunlap is entering his sixth season as the men's head basketball coach at his alma mater, Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. Known for his player development and on-the-floor coaching, Dunlap was previously the head coach of the Charlotte Bobcats for the 2012-2013 season, becoming the first coach in NBA history to win three times as many games as the year before. He also spent time as an assistant coach with the Denver Nuggets and served as a top assistant at Arizona, Oregon, and St. John's. Prior to his work as an assistant coach, he spent 9 seasons as the head coach at Metro State, leading his teams to national titles in 2000 and 2002, while earning NABC Division II Coach of the Year honors in both of those seasons. Coach Dunlap, whose teams went to the NCAA tournament in each of his 9 seasons, posted an overall record of 248-50, winning 5 Rocky Mountain Athletic Conference titles. Dunlap's previous head coaching experience also includes 3 seasons with the Adelaide 36ers in Australia's National Basketball League and 5 seasons at California Lutheran University. From 1994 to 1997, he led the 36ers to a 59-33 record and 3 straight appearances in the NBL Final Four, including advancing to the Grand Final game in 1995. His college coaching experience also includes 5 seasons as an assistant at Loyola Marymount from 1980 to 1985, 1 season at the University of Iowa, 85-86, and 3 seasons at the University of Southern California from 1986 to 1989. Coach Dunlap is known as one of the great minds in the game who elevates every player and team that he comes into contact with. Make sure you check out our website, hoopheadspod.com, where you can find and listen to every episode in our archive. After you're done with this episode or one of your other favorites, please head over to your preferred podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Those reviews help others in the basketball community find our show. Tell a friend about us, and if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast so you never miss an episode. The pod is available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, and YouTube. Open up your notebook and have your pen ready so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Mike Dunlap from Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Linzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Loyola Marymount University, Coach Mike Dunlap. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, fellas, for having me on.
Absolutely. We are thrilled to have you on the show tonight, get a chance to dig into all the great things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. I want to start out by going back in time and thinking about when you were a kid and how you got involved in the game of basketball. What made you fall in love with it?
I just think that it was, I lived in Fairbanks, Alaska, so indoors, great coaches all the way when we were tiny. It gave us something to do, and so I jumped in on that and fell in love from the moment I grabbed the ball to this point. So it's never changed, but I was lucky because I had really good coaches at a young age.
So how did you find, was indoor gym space tough to come by in Fairbanks, or did you find yourself having to shovel the snow, as we would typically think of somebody?
Yeah. No, the education up there was number one. So tax dollars, oil money, all of that stuff went into facilities. So we had really good facilities all the way through. And we had a really good basketball program in high school that all of the elementary school kids that played basketball aspired to be. And we, the guy who was running the program at Lathrop High School was a guy named Clara Markey, and he had coached Elgin Baylor at Seattle U, and he had played there. So he, all that means is he had a real clue. And we used to go to those games as kids, and it was a big, big deal. You'd get about 2,000 to 3,000 people because there wasn't much else to do. And so it was kind of like Friday Night Lights in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Did you find that the community support that you had there when you were in high school, as you go out now and you're recruiting and you go to high school games and you see kids playing, do you see that same type of involvement in the community as a general rule? Or do you think in high school basketball that there's less support just because of the way society is now? And there's so many more things for, let's say, other students to do, and people just don't go out and go to games as much as they used to.
Well, I do think it's a regional question or answer that, if you go to Texas or you go to Iowa, or it depends on where you're going. I think around the big cities, you see the disbursement on all those things that kids and parents would rather do than go to a basketball game. But if you were going to move into the heartland and you're recruiting, you're going into pack houses still, and it reminds you of what we were talking about. So it just depends on where you're flying into, you know.
Understood.
So it's still there. The backbone is still there.
When you were a high school player, talk about when you started to think that maybe you would have an opportunity to play beyond your high school years. At what point did you start looking and saying, hey, I want to be able to continue to play, and I think I'm going to have an opportunity to do that? When did you come to that realization?
I don't know that I ever came to the realization like that. I think I played scared the whole time that I wanted to play beyond high school. But there, you know, you didn't know. There were no recruiting services. There was, you know, no phones like that, you know, and iPhones or anything like that. You were in a different age completely. So you just didn't know. And I had exposure, though. I got an award when I was 14, and John Wooden came up, and they had a quarterback club. The irony of that is, you know, a quarterback club, and it was a basketball award, but I stood up. John Wooden spoke at this banquet. They flew him up, and he handed me a trophy. And I think that was the beginning of my dad explaining who John Wooden was. I mean, at 14, you know, you don't know. He didn't have all the championships yet, but he was, you know, the best of the best. And something within me triggered when my dad explained who John Wooden was. And then I was able to go down to Coach Wooden's camp. And so I was going to a camp on Woodby Island, and it was run by Ed Pebble, but it was Lenny Wilkins' basketball camp. And he was coupled with a guy named Bob Hoobriggs, he and George Mikan were the two that brought the hook to the NBA. And so anyway, this circuitous route down to Pepperdine, where they Wooden had his camp, and then it moved over to Kowloon. But I, you know, and then I did reasonably well at that camp. It was a big camp, lots of California guys and all that. And that was a brave new world for me. But I did reasonably well to the point where I said, you know what? If I dedicate myself, maybe, just maybe, I can play in college.
So two questions related to that. One, coming out of Alaska, how did you feel like the level of competition that you were competing against in Alaska compared to when you went to these camps in California, where obviously there's a much greater population and higher, you know, there's more kids playing there in California. So let's answer that first, and then I'll jump back to a question I have about John Wooden and your experience with him.
Well, number one is I had good coaching all the way up from grade school all the way to junior high. By this time, I was in junior high, and two things happened. And in the book Outliers, you know, Gladwell talks about having the best coaches and also having people say in your community you are one of the better players in that community. Well, that really helps your self-esteem. So then my first camp that I went to in conjunction with Wooden's was Snow Valley Basketball Camp, and I went the year before, and that was at Westmont. And that was considered the best basketball camp west of the Mississippi. There was Bill Foster's camp in the Poconos. So I'm not going to bore anybody any more than that. Five Star wasn't up and running at that point in a big way. So I did reasonably well, again, at that Snow Valley basketball camp. That was a tribute to really good coaching in the community I came from. And I was quick, so I was able to have a little bit of physical talent where I could go buy guys, and then I was a distributor. So all that meant was, by the time I got to Wooden's camp, I had a platform underneath my feet where I could compete against the California guys. By no means was I the best player at that camp. I'm not even going to intimate that, but I could go along to get along, and I could compete. So when I came back from those camps into my own community, it propelled me to being one of the better players in the state. And, you know, when people are telling you that all the time, whether you are or not, it really, really helps you. And that's what Gladwell talked about, where all the Canadians, you know, their birthdays were such that these guys were 1 year older than most that were playing because their birthdays fell on a certain date. So that gave them one extra year. And I would suggest that self-fulfilling prophecy, when you have people telling you all the time that you're pretty good at something, it really helps you be good at that, whatever that endeavor is.
Yeah, that type of psychological impact that those things have, and then obviously the physiological impact of being a year older than the kids that you're competing against, like you described in Gladwell's book. I mean, I think that's something that when you read that for the first time, you know, if you haven't thought about it and then you hear it for the first time, it's kind of amazing that that really can have as big of an outsized impact as it did when you look at those hockey players in Canada, the fact that they were able to do that.
Head Start Basketball's Cutthroat Game Building Program debuts on Tuesday nights in September. Players in grades 5 through 10, both boys and girls, you won't want to miss this one. Registration is open now at www.headstartbasketball.com.
Let's jump back to your impressions of John Wooden when he came to your community, and then also when you went down and got to his camp. Obviously, when you first had him come, you weren't that familiar with him. So what takeaways, or do you remember anything specific about meeting him for the first time or kind of seeing his coaching style or anything that you remember from back in that time?
Just that he was mesmerizing as a speaker. Obviously, he waxed on poetically, and then he had a number of anchors or cliches that he would use from Wordsworth, Byron, Shelley, Keats. He could do the romantics, or he could wander over to what his father said, and he could encapsulate paragraphs in one sentence. And so the way he did that, it just struck me that I'd never heard someone speak like that. And then second was, he was very disciplined, and you could tell that. Third is, he had a religious bent or slant to him that created an aura that when he walked through a room, you were dealing with somebody of values, and that you know, probably by all measure walked his talk in terms of how he acted. And so all of those things just hit me like a brick, you know, in the forehead. And so I just knew I wanted more of that. And so when I had a chance to go to his camp and the brochure came to me, I jumped all over it. I started working a job where I was cutting lawns and painting fences. And my dad had a deal. He would pay for the airline ticket if I paid for the camp. And that's what we did. So I did that part. My dad paid for the ticket. And there I was at 14. And, you know, I got a picture of next to Wooden and an award at the camp. And just that picture, that award among 300 kids, you know, made me think, hey, this is cool. And that it was just this kind of weird thing between Wooden and myself. And then when I finished my college career, the coach was close, Ed Gorgian, to John Wooden. And he said, I'm going to call Wooden up and I'm going to get you to his apartment in Encino. I was 21. So he put me on the phone with Wooden and he said, come on to my place. It was only a 40-minute drive from LMU. So I drove down there a number of times and literally sat in his living room and took notes on how to be a coach and those guidelines that he believed in. And it started a relationship that was much deeper. He says, oh, I remember you when you were 14. Oh, I remember you when you were at my camp. And anybody that came in contact with Coach knew that he had an incredible memory. So it wasn't just this bluster. And so he was one of my guides, as he was for many. But anyway, that helped a lot. And then by going to Snow Valley, I met as an instructor at 21. I met Pete Newell's son, Junior. And then that linked me into Pete Newell, who went to LMU, but it was Loyola back in the early 50s. And so I linked in with the Newell family. So here I was, on either side of me was Newell and Wooden. Who knew? You know?
Right, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And then I ended up working for George Raveling, who, in my opinion, put the polish on everything because he was ahead of his time as Speakers Bureau. You know, he put the book out on rebounding. He was a deflection chart guy. He was a guy that was way ahead of his time in the business of being professional. And what he did for my career was he brought in George Allen. He brought in Vic Bubas. He brought in Stu Inman, all of these famous people. And what they would spend 2 to 3 days on our staff as guest speakers and then hone us, his big staff at Iowa and then USC, where Xerox, he'd send us to a 2-day salesman thing where we would go to Xerox and learn how to talk on the phone to recruits and what you were looking for and how to close on a deal. I didn't know any of that. So I got really lucky all the way through to be surrounded by people that showed me. And then a very famous high school coach in this area named Ed Gorgian, who was a tremendous coach and ran a great practice. He was the one who said, here's your template for running a good practice. So, and then that led me to an introduction with Tim Gergovich, who is considered the best assistant that ever lived in the NBA. That's not even arguable at this stage. And I was lucky enough to be under his guidance as well. So I had all these guys, and then George Karl. I worked for George Karl. That was crazy. I mean, you know, so, I mean, it just goes on and on. And then, you know, to polish it off, I worked for Ernie Ken. I worked for Steve Lavin. And so I just had a compilation of really good coaches that had these prominent strengths at what they did. And I just kept throwing all their stuff in my bag. I was a consummate thief of all this stuff.
I think the best of us are, right? I think if you're a coach today, You're looking for things that you can steal, borrow, beg from to be able to use and incorporate into whatever it is that you do. When you were still playing, did you realize early on that coaching was going to be where you wanted to end up? And then after you answer that, just maybe talk to some of the younger coaches out there who might be listening about the importance of relationships and building relationships within the coaching profession and what those relationships can do for them. You've kind of described what they did for you, but talk a little bit about, did you always want to be a coach, or do you think it was all these guys that you just were able to come in contact with who were some of the giants of the coaching profession, do you think you would have come to coaching on your own, or would you think it was the influence of some of those guys that you know, that you were able to be lucky enough to be in contact with?
Number one is, in the fourth grade, I was so in love with the game. I didn't know the vehicle would be coaching, but I just never, ever wanted to be without the game. And then, then I recognized that someday that's what I wanted to do. I can't, say when it was, but I knew in the fourth grade that I just never wanted to be without the game. And so that's happened through the vehicle of coaching. Second, to answer your question, it's both. And then once I got around these people, they were funny. They were highly intelligent, and they were servant related. They were purists in the game. Wooden, Newell, Borgen, Raveling, Carl, they were servants of the game. And I watched them, help other people grow and live their dream and educate, in various forms. Coaches wear many different hats, and I had the best of the best role models. And I was from a town of 30,000 up in the northernmost reaches of the world in Fairbanks, Alaska. And so every day, basically, was an absolute wonderment of, like, how did I get here? What, and I just took advantage of it. I would tell every head, or young guy, there is the internet now. We had no access like they have to all of the greats. You can do serious damage on the internet and access information, but it's not near as important as getting out and watching a guy coach, whether it's Stan Van Gundy, whether it's Buzz Williams, whether it, is Billy Donovan. You have the ability, if you can pick up a phone and dial it, or now just use your cell phone, you can call any of those guys. And if you're determined, you can go watch them, do your own field study, write notes. And it's not the information you want, like you guys pointed to, it's the relationship you want. And they'll get a lot of first timers in their gym that'll come, take, and go. And I would tell all the young coaches, you go back three or four times and you won't see whomever you're sitting next to take the notes that third or fourth time. You'll outwill them. And that's where the relationship starts with the guys that are a bit grizzled in this game that know it, because they want to see a guy who's consistently not there just to take the information, but wants to, walk inside their headspace and get to know them as people. And it's the responsibility of the young guy to do that with the old guy, not the other way around. And they got to get up and go, get up out of your chair and put yourself in front of as many people and great coaches as you can.
Yeah, I think that investment of time that any coach sees when somebody comes to have a conversation with you, or somebody is coming to see your practice, I think if that person is willing to put time in and not, as you said, just have their hand out as a taker, but is actually willing to put that time in and build that relationship, I think that goes a long way to being able to have that younger coach be able to develop the type of mentorship and be able to gather something from that older coach so that they can get and give at the same time. I think you said it best when you said being a servant leader is a huge thing, whether you're an older coach in the game or whether you're a newer coach. You have to understand why you're there, and that's to serve the game, your players, the program, however you want to slice that and look at it. When you were having the opportunity to talk to all these great coaches, do you remember what your process was for internalizing the information that you were gathering from them? So did you have a journal, a notebook? Did you commit it to memory? How did you go about, as you were having these conversations with the coaches that you got to work with and spend time with, like when you went down and spoke to Coach Wooden at his house, did you take a notebook with you, or did you furiously scribble it down after you got home? How did you go about collecting all that information?
By that time, whether it was Ed Gorgon and George Raveling, as you never walked into a room without a yellow pad in those days, then it became a Franklin planner. Now you can use your app, and you can write off your notes right on your phone. It's in your pocket. It's easy to do. So it's evolved. But one of the things I remember reading a story and actually accessing an interview where Peter Uberoth had all those baseball commissioners and people that were affiliated with the Olympics. And he became the guy who made the first dollar that turned a profit in L.A. off the Olympics. But the major point was is he scolded all these owners that came in when he became the commissioner of baseball. And he said, I can't believe you guys that are millionaires in those days. There were no billionaires at that time. But he said, where's your notepad? But George Raveling was big on carrying a notepad. So, yeah, I took a notepad down to Wooden's. I wrote everything that he said, and then I codified it in a three-ring binder, you know, in those days. Now you can do all that on your phone and be, you know, in great shape, and then you put it, you know, encrypted into a cloud, and you can always have it, you know. So if you lose your phone, you've got it somewhere where you can access it. But anyway, yeah, copious notes. And then I would do them a second time and then put them in a notebook. And I've got notebooks everywhere, you know, of you know, whatever they said. One of the best that I ever was around. And it was a surprise when I got in front of him, only because I didn't know what a great teacher he was John Chaney at Temple. You know, he retired. But my God, he could talk in metaphors and similes and tell stories that made you, he stained your brain. He made you remember his teaching points. And I never, ever was in front of anybody who did it better than him. And he'd have you crying and laughing. You know, he was just a hilarious man. A lot of people didn't see that side of Coach Chaney, but I did. But my point is that all of these guys had great strengths. So all I tried to do was access what they were best at, because I couldn't remember everything. But with Wooden, he was the great organizer, and he knew how to flow a practice and build a practice because he put so much time in his preparation for it. So I didn't try and, you know, figure out Wooden with everything. I couldn't. I mean, he was that gifted. So what I tried to do is laser in on what guys are best at and then take that away from them and make it my own. That was it.
Yeah, I think that's the best strategy. You can't just blanketly copy everything that somebody does, because you have to fit your coaching to your personality and the way that you go about doing things. And I think that's a key takeaway for coaches out there, is if you can beg, borrow, and steal from the best minds in the game and then make it your own by putting little tweaks to it and taking the best of the best, as you just described. Can you, Mike, wrap up here with one last question and just talk about the – you've had the opportunity to coach basketball at lots of different levels, and from Division III college basketball to the NBA. Can you talk about the similarities between all those levels and what you found to be sort of the universal language of basketball, things that translate no matter whether you're talking about a high school player or you're talking about an NBA player, something that from your perspective as a coach doesn't change from the level of basketball, no matter where you're coaching at?
Yeah, I mean, people remember in threes and sevens. So, you know, that's the Holy Trinity. It goes on and on. So my point is methodology. It's really important, you know, in this time of information and too much information, you've got to be able to filter. And a lot of people chase plays and drills, and I get that. But really, the ones that are at the highest level, the one percenters, have a certain way of teaching. And so number one for me would be the ability to take the complicated and articulate it and simplify it. And whether it was Bill Walsh finding the winning edge, or whether you transition over to someone like Malcolm Gladwell, who could take vast amounts of information and then boil them down to common denominators. And I found that the great coaches are able to simplify and go. You know, when you watch a Jeff Van Gundy do a practice, the thing that is stunning, or Hubie Brown, is that how quickly they can get a group to go in one direction. You know, the buy-in would be number two, is that you're selling something, a system, a way of doing something. And so you have to have the capacity to sell. Number three is that truth. The NBA player will sniff you out in a second if they don't think you're authentic and you're there for the wrong reason. And I think that being authentic, even in your shortcomings, is way more important than being fancy. You know, number four would be is be competent. You know, the surgeon can be an alcoholic for 22 hours a day, but for 2 hours, he's the best surgeon in the world. You really don't care about the other 22 hours. You'd want that person to be competent when they're doing their surgery. And so when you're a teacher, you have to know your craft, you know, be it methodology and content of information. You have to keep studying, keep learning, because the game keeps evolving. Number five would be to me is don't take yourself so seriously. Have a sense of humor. Have some fun with your guys. Make fun of yourself. Make fun of a situation. There's so many things where you can bring humor to a practice and to a situation. It's not life and death. And they've got to know that you have the capacity to have fun with the game, because if the game becomes, you know, just nothing but drudgery and work, and they feel your anxiety, then they're going to be an anxious team on the floor, and you don't want them to be that. And that's enough right there. I think put a bow on it. Those are five bullet points, and that's good enough for this podcast, because I could go on for hours.
I'm sure you could. Can you tell us what book you're reading right now? Last question. What book are you reading right now? Because I know you're a huge reader.
Yeah, The Trillion Dollar Coach, Bill Campbell. He was a football coach at Columbia, and then he transitioned over to the business world, and he was the coach for Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. It goes on and on. And so they called him The Trillion Dollar Coach, and I'm reading about Bill Campbell.
Awesome. Mike, we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us tonight. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. Can you just let people know how they can find you, maybe on Twitter, if they want to reach out to you after hearing the podcast, and if they want to connect and follow you so they can pick up on some of the wisdom that you were able to share with us tonight?
Well, on the Twitter account, I'm on it. I have about 17,000 followers, you know, and I just put out strictly basketball information on that. And obviously it's Mike Dunlap. It's at coach, at coach Mike Dunlap. I
mean, awesome.
Yeah. And, but they can follow me that way. And here's another way that they can do that is that I'll give out my cell number. And if somebody calls me and leaves a message, and I know that some people think that's crazy, but I have enough assistance that I can get information out to them, you know, as far as, you know, I would say this. You know, in this day and age of the phone and websites and whatever, I try to put a human touch on a note and send people things if they request it, you know, and still stay in touch with people via mail, because that treasure, that trinket is still something you can put in your hand. I call it a transfer of energy. My information, which is Wooden's or Newell's or somebody else's, I just try to give all that stuff away. And so on the Twitter account, and all of that, I'm just trying to access or give people access to information that I took from somebody else. So my cell number is 310-242-1395. And if they want to call and they say, hey, I'm interested in this, if I can't do it, I'll make sure an assistant touches base so that they can get into my library and give them something.
Mike, that's awesome. I came away from after meeting you at the Jay Billis Skills Academy this summer, just came away so impressed. First of all, with our own individual conversation that we were able to have, and then when you presented to the coaches leadership program as well. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. It's been a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you, and to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.